There was a show in L.A. where they opened to Dinosaur Jr. It was a mid-sized theater called The Palace that held 600 or 700 people in my memory. And so I went to see that show. I think Kurt just wanted to see what the songs felt like in front of an audience. It wasn't a big payday or anything like that, or a high-profile show. But I had never seen them, so I went to that show, and I was really mesmerized by the intensity and intimacy and the contact that he had with the audience. And it was then that I realized how lucky I was to be involved with Nirvana. I kind of, prior to that, was kind of doing it because other people told me they were good. And that was when I realized how special he was, and therefore how special the band was.
If you're lucky, once in your life, you'll have a euphoric experience at a concert with a band you love, where everything vibrates at a frequency that is comforting and tingling. You're suddenly connected to all of the lights, the sounds, and the people there. For one of Nirvana's managers and author of Serving the Servant, Danny Goldberg, this was one of those moments.
You just felt like you knew him personally, even though you were one of several hundred people in the audience. And I'm not exactly sure mechanically how he did that, but I know that's how it felt, and I know that's how people felt in general about his performances. He had a real gift for connecting with people at a deeper level than most entertainers do.
Kurt Cobain's life is shrouded in scattered facts and urban myths. He may have started his music career alone, but his work touched so many lives and inspired so many wayward kids that his band Nirvana is a symbol of revolution and freedom. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. If a child is meant to be seen and not heard, then Kurt Cobain wouldn't exist. He was playing on toy drums, guitars, and pianos from the age of 2. As soon as he could hold a pen, he would fill journals with poetry and drawings. He was a very happy child, surrounded by family. But even at a young age, he was incredibly hyper. His parents struggled to keep up with his intense energy.
He certainly had a difficult childhood. He talked about it a lot. His parents got divorced when he was 9. He grew up in a logging town of Aberdeen where he was, like, you know, way smarter and more sensitive than other people there.
Kurt was devastated. Divorce wasn't common then, and he was living in a small town. Everyone was talking about his parents splitting up, and he was riddled with embarrassment. His mother couldn't handle his mood swings, so his father took him in. When his father got remarried and started a family, he struggled. He moved from family member to family member, never staying in one place for very long. As a displaced teenager, he started experimenting with drugs. He claimed it was a form of self-medication and discovery. An escape from a world he didn't understand. But it proved to only be a temporary solution. And as Kurt became more and more of an outsider, his manic depressive mood swings got worse, and suicidal thoughts became more frequent.
He was physically small. He was only about 5'8 and skinny and got bullied. He certainly identified with punk rock in part because it spoke in the voice of alienated kids. And he came out of that culture, and I don't think that ever completely left him. He always had that chip on his shoulder with regard to phoniness or the establishment or anything that he considered to be misogynistic or bigoted or overly materialistic or shallow.
In his search for a community, he was introduced to punk music, and from there his identity was set. He formed Nirvana with his bandmate Krist Novoselic at the age of 17. After years of playing in dive bars and practicing heavily, Nirvana sent their demo to Sub Pop Records and were signed. In 1989, Nirvana released their first album, Bleach. It wasn't an overnight success, but it was making waves in the underground punk scene and on college radios. It gave the band airplay and a chance to tour, but by no means was it the expressway to success. High school physics teacher Roberto LaRusso was a DJ at his college radio station and got to interview Kurt before a concert in London, Ontario.
We're sort of backstage. There's sound check going on, so it's loud in the environment, and there are people milling about, and we're sort of in this area, which is kind of like, looked like an abandoned cafeteria sort of thing. So there was just this sort of cafeteria round table that was enough seating for like two or three people. I hit record, and then I don't remember what I opened with, but I remember I decided that I'd start talking about our mutual interests or my interests, and I thought that might settle me down. And in hindsight, that's actually probably the more interesting part of the interview, was the non-interview part, was just the stuff that we were talking about, which happened to be like pirate radio and all this sort of stuff. And it actually turned out to be this really cool conversation. He was quite, almost like he was a bit introverted, just, you know, like, okay, this is kind of awkward. And he was just, you know, he was relatively quiet, wasn't entirely enthusiastic about the interview. And I remember feeling at the time that something wasn't quite right. I had this weird little feeling that it just really, I thought he would be much more engaged and excited. He almost seemed somewhat indifferent to it all. And I thought that was a bit curious. But he was, for the most part, cordial, but I wouldn't exactly say he was fully engaging. However, people have told me that as far as interviews have gone with Kurt Cobain, the one that I got out of him was actually one of the most candid, which I thought was rather shocking, because I thought it was a train wreck of an interview. And others have said, actually, you got him to talk about things that he'd never talked about before.
While on tour, Kurt began suffering from debilitating stomach pains. He would feel nauseous and vomit often. After several visits to the doctor, there was no diagnosis for his condition, and he began to self-medicate with heroin. As their audience grew and they gained more popularity, the band left Sub Pop Records, signed with manager Danny Goldberg, and moved to Geffen Records.
He was pretty sophisticated at an early age as an artist, but obviously as he did it more, he grew as his life experiences changed, he grew. But he also developed tools later on that he didn't have when they made Bleach. He really respected Chris and Dave. I mean, Chris and him started the band together. They were like brothers. Dave was the fourth drummer in the band and by far the best one, and Kurt was incredibly appreciative of how brilliant Dave was musically, but it was Kurt's band. Kurt wrote the songs. Kurt made all the decisions about everything.
Kurt tightened the ship and had the band rehearsing the songs for their new album Nevermind every day. They started promoting the new album's debut single, Smells Like Teen Spirit, with local college and independent radio stations. During an interview on a college radio station, they invited the public to come out and be in the music video.
Then they announced on the radio, we're doing a video, anybody who wants to be in it, show up at such and such a time. So I don't know whether all of the kids who showed up went to that college or whether some of them just listened to the station. Because you didn't have to go to the college to listen to that station. You know, it was very chill. They were in a good mood. They knew they were doing something cool. The kids in the audience were getting more and more stoned. It was a little out of control, which made the director a little nervous, but Kurt thought it was cool. The more chaotic it got, those shots, that sense of weirdness was part of the power of the video. So he conceived of the whole thing. You know, he storyboarded it. He knew every shot that he wanted in it. He was a full Renaissance artist. He did everything. He designed the album covers. He planned out the videos, he wrote the songs, he played lead guitar, he was the lead singer, he made all the decisions. So again, it was a band, but he was definitely the boss.
Smells Like Teen Spirit was the anthem for outsiders in the 90s. Nirvana may have played it to large audiences, but it was Kurt Cobain's message of freedom and nonconformity that tethered teenagers to discmans around the world. He could never have realized the impact that song would make. Danny Goldberg was gobsmacked.
Everything changed after Smells Like Teen Spirit was exposed to the public. Within days, the reaction was so intense and so out of proportion to what we expected that that our expectations grew by leaps and bounds with every passing day.
Kurt became the spokesman for a disaffected generation. Then, Kurt met Courtney.
Their romance started a few weeks after Nevermind came out. I happened to be at a show in Chicago at a club called The Metro that Courtney came to. The club held 500 people, and there were at least that many people outside the club who couldn't get in. It was an incredibly exciting moment. And the band was great. It was a very special time for them, and they knew they were doing great, but the byproducts of success weren't stressing them out yet. She came into the dressing room, introduced herself to me. I had heard about her, and the next thing I noticed was that she was sitting on Kurt's lap in the corner of the club. And you know, she's physically taller than Kurt, but you know, they just both had this very happy expression on their face, like the proverbial cat that swallowed the canary. And when I spoke to Courtney about that moment, she said they kind of flirted with each other over the previous couple of years, but that was the moment that they, you know, that was the first night they slept together, and they were then together for the rest of his life. You know, I recognized pretty quickly that Kurt was in love with her. Maybe one of the advantages of being older is I just knew right away that this was a real relationship and that it wasn't just kind of a rock and roll one-nighter or one-weeker. And other people didn't, and there were people that for one reason or another didn't like Courtney, and there was not everybody was so friendly to her, and I was, partially because I'd heard about her before and partially because I could just see what the vibe was. And that made me a lot closer to both of them from then on. So, he was in love with her. They two incredibly smart, ambitious people from damaged backgrounds, a lot of the same cultural references, a lot of the same values, both of them with drug problems that haunted each of them at different times and haunted them together for some of the time they were together. There's no question that he was in love with her. And she was in love with him. It was that's just the reality. There were good days and bad days, but they were definitely it was a very real romance. It was the most important romantic relationship of his life, and the mother of his daughter.
Coming up, we'll find out how Kurt Cobain defends his family against the Guns N' Roses frontman Axl Rose. We're sponsored this week by SimpliSafe. Did you know that there are over 2 million burglaries reported every year in America? That's one every 13 seconds, people. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes has home security. Maybe that's because most companies really don't make it easy for you. You call the big brands, and their packages can be so confusing and expensive, and their systems can be a huge hassle to install, not to mention the actual package themselves. I mean, the keypads and trying to do that in the dark with the dog barking and the ringing in your ears, it's a nightmare. But that's why I love SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe protects your whole home, every window, every room, and every door with 24/7 monitoring at a fraction of the cost. For your total peace of mind, you can't put a price on sanity, people. SimpliSafe is easy to order, and set up is super simple and usually completed in under an hour with no wires. No drilling. There's no contract, no hidden fees, no fine print. So if you want around-the-clock monitoring for just $15 a month, visit simplysafe.com/lifelived. You'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. That's simplisafe.com/lifelived. simplysafe.com/lifelived.
Nirvana came from complete obscurity to world fame overnight. Kurt was under fire with interview demands, flashing lights, promo demands, and TV spots. He hated it, and this fed into more drug use.
He was very hard on himself, that's for sure. He was constantly, after a show, saying, oh, that sucked. And he worked very, very hard on the songs, reworking them to get them the way he wanted. And he had a very clear picture in his mind of what he wanted, and he was able to actualize it. He was always striving, that's for sure. I think he knew he was good. I think he was proud of those records. And when after Nevermind came out, I mean, he anthologized his earlier unreleased tracks on this record called Incesticide. He's 24 years old. He's already anthologizing his early career. So I think he was confident in his art, but he was also very hard on himself in getting what he wanted. And he knew what he wanted. He had a very clear idea in his mind of what he wanted.
Nirvana's album Nevermind skyrocketed on the charts, bringing the band to a head-on collision course with the world. Kurt and Courtney became the poster couple for the rock and roll world. In February 1992, they got married in Hawaii, and shortly after announced they were pregnant. An article in Vanity Fair exposed that the Cobains were drug users and accused Courtney of using heroin while knowingly pregnant.
Well, Courtney decided to cooperate with the interest of a Vanity Fair journalist named Lynn Hirschberg to do a profile on her. And, Vanity Fair then as now was this gigantic mainstream show, magazine that to the extent they covered entertainment, it would often be, like movie stars, Tom Hanks, or they would do Madonna. They didn't cover rock and roll very often. And if they did, it was only the most sort of iconic figures like a Mick Jagger or somebody like that. But Courtney had been on a roll, the last couple of years. She had formed this band. She got signed first to Caroline Records, got Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth to produce it, got some press, falls in love with Kurt, marries him, gets signed to a major label. She had tremendous confidence that her own impulses were serving her well. And, this turned out to be an impulse that did not serve her well. The decision to kind of go with the mainstream, to cooperate and open herself up to such a mainstream journalist. And I think Courtney felt that she had really charmed her and that it was going to be this great article. And then, when it was published in August of 92, just about a week or 10 days or so before Francis was born, it had a devastating impact because it described Courtney as shooting heroin while she knew she was pregnant. My belief then, as it is now, is that as soon as Courtney found out she was pregnant, she stopped, and indeed Francis was born healthy. But this was not knowable when the Vanity Fair article came out because Francis hadn't been born yet. She was about to be born. And it was a devastating accusation of immorality, beyond just getting high or being rebellious. It was, it was it was unnamed sources that said this. And then there was a quote from Courtney that Courtney denied having said. The picture was... And again, I believe Courtney because I was there for so much of this and I know what the result was. But at the time, it was just devastating. So the city of Los Angeles or the LA County, I forget which entity, had a child protection or services that did an investigation on whether they were fit parents or not. And there were months went by during which, Courtney's half-sister had to be the official custodian while they went through a series of hoops to prove to the city that they were fit parents. And I mean, you just had a kid. I mean, you know, you can only imagine it's complicated enough being a parent. And then to do it under the spotlight of that kind of publicity. And, you know, so it really made them much more paranoid about the media after that. And it caused a tremendous amount of stress for some time to come. You know, we issued a statement denying it. There was talk about litigation, but, you know, it's very hard to win a lawsuit against a major publisher. It would have added more publicity to the controversy. There was no guarantee of the outcome, and it didn't make sense. What made sense was to just go into treatment, to go to counseling, to do all the things necessary to get control of their life, which they did do. But it was a scar that never completely went away in terms of showing that fame did not eliminate certain types of vulnerability.
After a short time, the Cobains were reunited.
He was good with young kids, and he adored his daughter, and you know, it didn't solve all of his problems, unfortunately. I mean, he had demons and emotional problems that ultimately killed him. But he loved his daughter. He was a doting, typical doting father, you know, like all of us are with our first kid. And there is something in particular about that father-daughter thing.
Nevermind became the number one rock and roll album in America. Kurt and Courtney completed rehabilitation and focused their energy on their family. In August of 1992, MTV asked Nirvana to perform for their Video Music Awards. Kurt didn't want to. He was still frustrated with the Vanity Fair article and the unwanted media attention, but he wanted to honor the support of MTV and his fans. Eventually, he agreed. He brought Courtney and Francis Bean to the show.
The Video Music Awards was MTV's big show of the year, was their highest rated show of the year. And in 92, they took place in the end of August, just a couple of weeks after Francis had been born and a few weeks after the Vanity Fair article had come out. So all of these things happened within days or weeks of each other. In terms of the award show itself, Kurt originally didn't want to do it. This was the first award show after Nevermind, so this was going to be the first time they were nominated. And MTV really wanted them to perform on the show because they were now one of the biggest stars that MTV had. There was a place outside that was set up for with trailers for the different artists, and then a buffet area for where the artists and their entourages could eat, waiting for the broadcast to start. He was in a great mood. He, you know, liked meeting some of the other artists that were there. He met a couple of the members of Queen. He'd been a closet Queen fan as a kid, and introduced himself to Peter Gabriel, who he admired, and Francis was there, and he was Googling her, you know, and so he was in a good mood, even though he had been pressured into doing a different song that he wanted. And so after the Vanity Fair article came out, Axl Rose at a concert had given this rant to an audience about how Kurt and Courtney were both criminals and they should go to jail, and saying these terrible things about them, they're junkies and this and that. And, you know, even though there was no, the internet was not, you know, it was just in its infancy, word still spread quickly in the rock and roll world. There was a journalist there, it was picked up by a wire service, it's mentioned. So Kurt and Courtney knew about this. So when Axl Rose walked into this same kind of buffet area with his girlfriend at the time, who was a model named Stephanie Seymour, and he had these two giant bodyguards with him, Courtney looks up and says, "Hey, Axl, want to be godfather to our baby?" And she's holding Francis. And Stephanie Seymour, thinking that she was being clever, looks askance at Courtney and says, "Are you a model?" And Courtney, without missing a beat, says, "Are you a brain surgeon?" So Axl Rose then came over to Kurt and said, "You shut your woman up or I'll put you down at the, you know, I'll put your head down to the pavement." And he's got these two big bodyguards there. So I'm sitting, again, there was just four or five of us sitting with Kurt and Courtney at this little table. They were just trying to keep, it was just so surreal. And so Kurt, in this kind of sarcastic, slacker voice, says to Courtney, "Shut up, bitch." Like just mocking the whole notion that he would ever, you know, tell his woman to shut up. And Axl in a huff stormed away. And then Kurt told this story, like, for the rest of his life, you know, and especially after the show, regaling the media with this tale of the macho Axl Rose and how insulting he was, you know, to women and so on and so forth. So that became kind of a semi-legendary incident.
Kurt became severely depressed after the attack on his family and struggled to rebound. In 1993, Nirvana released In Utero as a response to critics of his work and his family. It shot to number one almost instantly, solidifying Nirvana's talent and following. They performed on MTV's Unplugged in New York, playing their lesser-known songs and covers of songs from the Vaseline's and David Bowie. The band toured Europe, and Kurt brought Courtney and Francis with him. While in Rome, Kurt was found unconscious in his hotel room. He had overdosed and was taken to hospital. When they returned to America, Courtney pleaded with Kurt to get help.
I got a call from Courtney in March sometime, asking if I would come to an intervention. She was really worried that he was the worst he'd ever been in terms of heroin use and was just depressed all the time, and even Francis couldn't cheer him up. And so I agreed. It was fine for me to do that, even though I had this other job that was kind of part of the DNA of that job. And, you know, a bunch of us went there and tried to talk him into going to rehab and to stop doing heroin. And I think Courtney was desperate and trying to figure out what she could do to help. And in retrospect, it's something none of us can feel great about since he killed himself 10 days later. But at the time, it seemed like you got to stop doing the drugs in order to deal with any other problems that are bothering you. Whatever those problems are, artistic, professional, or personal, you know. He was the worst I'd seen him. I'd seen him stoned before, but it was hard because it wasn't just me visiting him. It was this seven or eight people, and the drama of the intervention, on the one hand, that has the virtue of getting someone's attention. On the other hand, it creates a real strain. It's not the most relaxing, intimate way to communicate with somebody. So, you know, it was depressing. I told him what I thought. I called him when I got back to L.A. because that's where the family still was. So it only took me a couple hours to get home from Seattle to L.A. and talk to him one more time and just, you know, said, look, I'm sorry if I was, I didn't mean to be judgmental or unfriendly. I love you so much. I just want you to be better and to feel better. And so, you know, we had that last talk on the phone. I put him on the phone with my daughter for a minute because he liked talking to her. But, you know, and that was the last time I spoke to him.
On April 5th, 1994, in the guest house of his Seattle home, Kurt Cobain committed suicide. He left a note addressed to his childhood imaginary friend, Bada. It honored his wife, his daughter, and his fans.
It was a shock. It was not a complete surprise in the sense that he talked about suicide. He had a drug problem. He was prone to depression. We know the history of artists, but the actuality of it was devastating. You know, I was really hoping and praying that he would turn it around. So many people do get into 12-step programs or some other path that allows them to stop being addicts, you know, whether it was, but he was not one of them. So it was just devastating. And then I was like on autopilot just to get home and go to the funeral and those kind of things. So it's still 25 years later, I'm still processing the reality of that. As anybody who's close to someone who kills themselves, you never completely get over it. But, you know, in the moment, it was just going on autopilot and dealing with what I had to do.
Roberto LaRusso was driving when he heard the devastating news.
I was in my 1988 Buick Regal, moving back from Montreal back to London, Ontario. And I was just, you know, listening to, you know, a similar radio DJ to me, actually talking rather flippantly and negatively about, you know, somebody who decided to off themselves in a pretty angry and spiteful way. And I'm just like, wow, who the hell are they talking about? And I remember thinking to myself, it's just like, okay, dude, this person killed themselves. Like, don't be so harsh. And I, you know, and of course the station's fading in and out, so I'm having a hard time trying to hear. So finally, after about 10 minutes, I'm intently listening, and it dawns on me, you know, he mentions Nirvana. I'm like, no. So then I start flipping around the dial, And then I every single radio station, commercial and non-commercial alike, is talking about this. And I'm like, oh my God. And the entire 8-hour drive home, I am listening to interview after interview, call-in shows right across the entire region. And I'm picking up, and in that location, I'm hearing radio from the United States. I'm hearing stations from Canada, right? Because I'm right there at that the border region, and I'm listening to like independent radio, and I'm hearing all these people's perspectives. So I was consuming this for 8 hours straight by myself, and I had no one to call, or I didn't have a cell phone, and there was just no way to communicate with anybody. I'm just sitting there trying to process this thing for 8 hours on my own. And of course, when I get home, I'm calling my buddies, and I'm like, what the f*** just went on, right? And it was like mind-numbing, and it was and consuming that much information. And I remember being just, you know, just desperate for more information, because I just couldn't believe it. I was like, I was having a hard time processing this.
Makeshift memorial services popped up around the world. Teenagers, outcasts, and misfits played Nirvana's music and cried into candles. The leader of the revolution was gone, but his music was and still is everywhere.
I never saw him as, you know, this god status. I saw him as a regular person who just happened to transcend these things that limit everyone else. And I thought that was really powerful, and at the same time, devastating that effectively he found a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And it's pretty heartbreaking. And I never was angry that he killed himself, in the sense that other people were angry, because I was more sympathetic, because I looked at it this way. It's like, The mental torture that he must have gone through to see this as an alternative to his current life must have been pretty severe, because when you have the world by the ass like you do and still can't find joy, right, that's some serious pain going on. They cared about the same thing that we cared about, which was just, you know, creating great music. And they, I don't think, were fully embraced this transition into this rock and roll stardom. And I don't think that was as interesting to them, but their fans certainly reinforced that. And I think that's obviously the lasting legacy, because when I still talk to my friends, when I talk to them about Nirvana, I can see them, you know, they talk about these artists like the same way you would talk about, you know, other incredibly famous, you know, artists or of the past. It's like, it's really the myth of what these people were as opposed to what they actually were.
He reinvented rock and roll at a time when it was becoming more and more pop and more mainstream, and found a way of integrating the rebellious energy of 80s punk and counterculture values into the 90s rock and roll world, and opened the door for many other artists who caused the so-called grunge era of, you know, artists like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, and later on Green Day and Offspring kind of came in the wake of Nirvana, proving that there was a mass audience for punk influence rock and roll. He was one of the great geniuses. He wrote the songs, he was the singer, he designed the videos, and he was a sweetheart who also cared about other people and had good political views, and also bedeviled by self-destructive demons and propensity for heroin addiction, and killed himself at the age of 27. And but a lovely, lovely person. Whatever darkness he had was directed at himself. He was quite kind and thoughtful to other people.
You can read more about Kurt's life offstage in Danny Goldberg's book, Serving the Servant. Roberto LaRusso is still teaching, and his band Red Arms have just released their first album, Welcome to the New Cold War. For more details, go to redarms.bandcamp.com. Next time on A Life Lived.
We had a little bit of this entitlement of how we were raised. So she walks in the room, that Beverly Hills princess, and it's obvious to George Lucas that this is the girl with the attitude that's the space princess. She's the Beverly Hills princess. That transcends to the Alderaan princess. She walks in, she gets in Darth Vader's face, and she doesn't back down, just like Molly Brown, just like the Beverly Hills princess. Nice combination of both.
Todd Fisher tells me what it was like growing up Hollywood royalty with his rebel princess sister, Carrie Fisher. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak, assistant produced by Paige Waller. Thank you so much for all of the wonderful feedback you've been giving us on the podcast and all of the amazing suggestions on future icons to cover. Now, remember, if there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can always find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.